You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Thank you, our five presenters. Very rich papers, which are impossible to summarize, I think. But let me do an attempt to at least find the red threads going through all of them. I think there was an agreement that clear public policies on the social economy, social and solidarity economy, are needed, and that these policies need to be formulated in a participatory manner. And to do so, we need a national organization representing social economy actors that can take part in these formulation processes. The policies need to be complemented by appropriate laws, and Hagen pointed out the case of cooperative law, and need to be underpinned by budgets, by budgetary provisions, because the policies without budgetary provisions are not very effective. I think there's also an agreement that the social and solidarity economy deserves support and protection because of the social and societal outcomes that they produce compared to more conventional, purely economic enterprises. But at the same time, we need to preserve the autonomy of these social economy organizations. Many of these policies and laws are national or even supranational, but the social economy organizations are local and act primarily at the local level. And we must also recognize that in many countries, social economy organizations, institutions existed long before policies and laws were made. The law followed the existence of these organizations. Now we have about 10, 15 minutes for discussions, comments, and questions. And I have one speaker from behind, second one. First speaker from behind, please introduce yourself briefly before.
Thank you very much for fantastic presentations. I'm Il Chung Yi, research coordinator of UNRIST. My question goes to Ms. Justine Nanonyo. I think the important issue in rural development in developing countries is land ownership related issues, and I thought about kind of a possibility to broaden the scope of social policy or public policy we are talking about to include land ownership or land tenure system. Given that Uganda has different kinds of land tenure system, it would be great to have more explanation about the relationship between rural cooperatives and land tenure system in Uganda, how cooperatives in rural areas have been affected by different land tenure system in Uganda could be very much interesting a discussion for to think about the possibility of SSE. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ben Quinones. From RIPES and the Asian Solidarity Economy Council. I have two questions, one for the panels and the other for Mr. Henry. The first question is, what is the relationship between the effectiveness and policy and the maturity of institutional mechanism for implementing that policy? Now, let me just clarify what I mean by this question. The case of small producer credit, which was a policy instrument, and microfinance, which was not a policy instrument. Now, we know that agriculture credit, highly subsidized agriculture credit, was a policy instrument introduced by the World Bank, supported by the regional development banks, and implemented by governments, and it was a complete failure. It left many institutions collapsed in many developing countries. On the other hand, microfinance was introduced without any policy environment. In fact, very harsh policy environment, because if you hear Professor Yuno says, and you ask him, what did you do to make microfinance successful? What I did was to do the opposite that banks are doing. And what are banks doing? They're doing the policy instrument of subsidized credit. Now, agriculture cooperatives, the way I understood Ms. Nanyunyu's presentation was that when the Ugandan government had this policy, the cooperatives were in a shambles. And then the government retreated, and the UCA came up. They started a people's movement cooperatives. It became very strong. In 2011, there was a policy, and again, there was confusion. The government did not know what to do. They went into implementation, created an institution to compete with ACE, and there is a confusion of the role of the cooperatives and the government. So that is the context of my question. Is there a relationship? And if there is a relationship, what is that? Is that directly proportional between the effectiveness of policy instrument and the maturity of institutional mechanism, or what? Because if we just say in this conference, we need policy for the development of social solidarity economy, I don't buy that. So I'd like an explanation from the panel, because your recommendation is very, very important. Now to Mr. Henry. I was struck by your statement that you said there are global players nowadays that are beyond the control or reach of national laws. Now I can cite one reason why. Because the UN only has two pillars that provides the global context for international law. One is the UN Charter, that is for peace and development. The second pillar is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, what is human rights? It is me, my rights. Yeah. What is lacking is the Universal Declaration of Human Responsibilities. Now, social solidarity economy is not born out of rights. It is born out of ethics and responsibility. It is an ethical approach to development. It is a shared responsibility to development. My question to Mr. Henry is, can there be an effort? Is an effort to have a declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Responsibilities, necessary in order that global players who mess up in countries like developing countries can be held accountable? Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Corina Simon. I have been a part of a SSE organization, and I would like to bring the perspective of one organization that has decided to engage in policy change. For us, this has been an issue of vision, strategy, capacity, and resources. First of all, to be able to create, to have a vision that goes beyond this year or into 5 years, 4 years at least for an election process, but really a generation to see the future in such a way that our policy change is relevant for our children, then to be able to find the time to create objectives that are clearly represented in the time that the institutions are here and now, to be relevant to their processes. And this coming from the time to understand the system of policy change, which is not in the usual life of an SSE organization. We really have to deal with implementation of our programs. So how do we formulate in such a way that our vision is clear and explainable, not only for the policymakers, but also for the general public, the people that we're working for? And to create it in a language which is not our own. It's not the people's language. It's jargon. It's complicated, conceptual, and so on. Then in relation to how we make this formulation known, then we need to see where to go, which meeting to attend, which relationships to develop, who do we send that has the ability to speak in that language and to speak from us as well, and to give the resources for these networking meetings. These are full days where a person is not in the local area. And many times this has to do with the place where policies get changed. They are usually capital cities, Brussels, Geneva, New York. This implies a lot of funds. And even if there is an intermediate networking body, their capacity is also something that we cannot influence. Membership fees, networking days, and so on. This has made us realize that we, as one organization, are maybe not every time possible to be at the right place at the right time, having the right message, but also to be able to work with research institutes, whether national or private, and policy think tanks, and students who make their master's thesis in order to make our policy or policy change known and to have our voice heard. So this overall is a whole department, even if it's one person. But this department and this person has to communicate to all the people in the organization what is our policy change, what are our messages, and to get them to speak them wherever they are. And also our membership and our constituencies to be able to tell from them and from us what do we want to have changed. So it sounds great. We want to participate. There is a lot of things to be done in order to do that. Thank you.
More questions, and I think we have to interrupt. Lady, please.
My name is Heike Wach, and I'm a member of the Swiss platform of WIDE, that is Women in Development Europe. And we work on the economy of care, of which the economy related to food security is one element, where women very often in unpaid and lesser paid positions sustain a majority of activities. I have now two questions related to the SSE. That is, we've seen a lot of cooperation between policy and SSE, where there is a win-win situation, which helps communities sustain food security in the area of agricultural production and marketing. Now, what about the conflicting situations? I will name two examples. One is land grabbing, which takes place in many of the countries, in very many of the countries concerned, which is something that is driven by sporadic interests, both in governments and in the private sector. And there, the cooperatives, the organizations of small farmers play a very important role. What is their voice in this setup of policy cooperation? And the other one is that there is a World Agricultural Report which promotes small-scale farming and cooperatives and other another agricultural paradigm. But with the influence of the private sector, this has been totally weakened. And so I wonder now where this SSE players can come back and how they can actually, where you see perspectives that these players can really influence big issues in agricultural development and in power relations. Or is there a danger now to mainstream SSE and then they will be doing little bits everywhere to stop maybe some hunger, but not to really change anything. Thank you.
And allow only one final question. There's a lady from far behind.
Thank
Perhaps
you.
During the coffee break, you can have some conversations.
Thank you very much. I'm Berenice Alcalde. I'm doing my PhD in this subject, and also I'm working here at ILO. I will speak in French. I have two questions, but I will put it in French.
Well, I just wanted to put two questions. I wanted to know, first of all, what your recommendations would be regarding, well, you were saying earlier that the SSE and all of the organizations and actors within that has established laws which are imposed on the principles and values of the SSE and the actors themselves. I was wondering how to avoid all the issues around obligations and restrictions and ensure that the laws are flexible, because we need to ensure that all actors can develop along the avenues that they wish to do so and that there are no obstacles and barriers. The second question, I think that, as you know, as regards laws in SSE, if we look at Latin America, it's clear that at least 7 countries have already set up laws in this area or are in the process of doing so. And they're ahead in comparison to other regions. And so I wondered why you thought that in this region in particular, policymakers are managing to develop laws in this area and not elsewhere in other regions. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I think I would first ask Justine to respond to some of the questions, and Hagen, and then the other members of the panel. We cannot have more than 10 minutes for the answers. Justine, please.
Thank you. I'll mainly focus on the issue of, I think, land tenure. I must say that the farmers, the small farmers in Uganda, are still faced with the problem of not having enough availability to land, but also ownership. Most of them are hiring land at quite a high cost, and sometimes they are being, you know, like chased away from the land by the owners, who are then selling it to rich businessmen. So, but only recently, I think the government has changed the land law to say that, I think, squatters cannot be chased away from the land. I think they have a right to stay on the land. But still, I think there's a lot more needs to be done in terms of reforming the land system, maybe for the small farmers to have access to more land. Maybe they need to be given some loans to purchase their own land, and so on. Now, there was an issue about, I think, land which can be used for food security, and how can the cooperatives try to change the situation. I know that in the case of Uganda, I mean, farmers or the cooperative movement holds annual meetings or meetings when they are needed, and they discuss a number of issues, and then which can be presented to the government via the Uganda Cooperative Alliance. So that's the main channel through which they can make suggestions to government on how they can be helped as far as issues of land are concerned. That's mainly what I have to say. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very tempted to also say something on the land law issue, for the very simple reason that in my previous life I did research quite a bit on land law, especially in Africa, but I tried to tie it into the other issues. Well, land law is, or land in general, especially when we talk about agriculture, but also for other purposes, is of course a very thorny issue, and land grabbing is one of the big issues. There was mention about credit to farmers. And that is where the link is. I mean, the World Bank and other international institutions did not only, have this policy of giving cheap credit to farmers, and it failed, but they also advocated something which was to say, well, then you should give your land as collateral, which in Europe, for example, for centuries was not possible. You could not give your agricultural land as collateral against credit. It was a very wise measure. Now, coming and linking now these two with cooperatives, the previous recommendation on co-optives of the ILO, 1966, 127, made expressly the link between land issues and co-optives. Very interesting. This has been forgotten, but I think the subject is coming up again because you just can't forget the issue because it's burning again. But for several decades, I mean, there was very little on land law issues in the development debate. About the responsibilities, I fully agree, as you might imagine. There is a problem with lawyers, in fact, because lawyers for some time now have lost this concept that you cannot have a right without an obligation. That goes together. There is a fantastic article, those who are interested to read it, 1923, by Hohfeld in the United States, a legal philosopher, who makes this very clear, that these cannot be separated. But unfortunately for most lawyers, including myself sometimes, we tend to forget we separate the obligation from the right in the sense of a claim. These have to be brought together now with a separate declaration, you know, that. But I fully agree something has to be done to bring these issues again together. An example, I mean, the African Charter of Human Rights does that. So maybe that could be globalized, so to speak, as an idea for sure. Just one last thing about the how can we ensure that laws are facilitating what we are trying to do and not too restrictive? Well, that's a long story, of course. I mean, I have no recipe. Nobody has. But I just invite you to think law in different terms. It can be restrictive. Yes, it can be controlling, and that also is necessary, but it can also be used for change. It can be used to facilitate. When you play football, it's not only restricting rules which you abide by, they're also, you know, enabling you to do what you want to do, and that's the same in other parts of life. Thank you.
Thank you for the great questions. I'll just answer briefly, in the interest of time, two that I think are particularly relevant to what I looked at. One, regarding the relationship between policy instrument effectiveness and the maturity of institutional mechanisms. In my experience looking at the research that I did, I think that the key is the maturity of participatory relationships involved in institutional mechanisms. One of the major points of difference in the Mercosur programs that I looked at, in the Uruguay pilot program for the social solidarity economy for regional integration, one of the failures had cited in the evaluation of the report had to do with a lack of a strong link between the target community and the social ministry, the social development ministry that was implementing the program. Whereas looking at the programs that have worked in collaboration with a special meeting on cooperatives of Mercosur, the RECM, I would say that of the three programs that we looked at, those were definitely the most successful and largely relied on a relationship with the special meeting of Mercosur cooperatives that has developed over a decade and really counts on a dynamic presence of the cooperative movement through that representative body and ensures a sort of a system of checks and accountability to the target population because of their presence at policymaking discussions. And then the other question about the conflicts that have arisen between policy and the social solidarity economy, and especially the voice of small-scale farmers and in the context of land grabbing. Thank you very much for pointing that out. It's really highlights sort of one of the key points of our paper that essentially focusing on SSE as social policy targeting marginalized areas and not focusing on the centers of economic policymaking leaves intact the economic mechanisms that are driving land grabs in much of the Southern Cone and leaves out the voices of small farmers that are displaced by those economic production models. So, yes, it is a big issue area to be addressed. So thank you.
sorry. In response to the question of maturity of institutional mechanisms, I basically would repeat what Zoe said, that from the case studies that came out, the importance was not so much, or maybe it's a question of what we mean by maturity. It's not so much how long these policies have existed or how well entrenched they are in government, but really the forms in which they take and to what extent they incorporate stakeholders and actors of the social economy. In Quebec, this process has been taking place for some time, and it works well. In other places, there's been policies for some time for the social and solidarity economy in Korea, but they're very restrictive in terms of what kind of input they allowed from actors from the terrain. So it's, yes, they've in both cases been around for a while, but don't have the same kind of impact. To just echo what the person was saying about the difficulty of engaging with public policymakers, I think this underscores the importance of intermediary organizations. On the one hand, because they have sort of the capacity in terms of time and resources and analysis to look at what the needs are of, or what the, to interface with government agencies. At the same time, it's critical that they're representative and that they're, and in turn, talking to the actors on the terrain so that they're both representing their needs, informing them, and able to mobilize them and include them in this process. So I think they have a double role, intermediaries have a double role to play, to be accountable to the actors and to transmit their needs and explain what's going on, distill that information, which people working in the terrain don't necessarily have time or resources to do, and at the same time push for changes towards government. And that just brings me to the question of land grabbing I'm not going to speak to, but I think that that the voice of the social economy is really a function of that, of on the one hand, institutional inclusion that governments can grant, a place at the table for actors, but also actors' capacities to mobilize and speak and force their way into having a seat at that table. I think then that sort of answers the question of comment éviter l'imposition des lois. C'est vraiment that they have a seat at the table to be able to say what they agree with, what they don't, and what is convenient for them.
I think that in general, these questions are important to rethink a lot of things. In this conference, in this table example, and with these questions, we need to rethink about the microfinance, some experience of microfinance. Microfinance aren't real kinds of microfinance because the interest rate are high, and we need to think other kinds of funding and a real ineffective microfinance. Example, the Solidarity Rotative Funds, that are some experience that are emerging that are important to look and to analyze. Thank you. Another question, it's the market. I think that's the rethink the conditions of the market. The market, it isn't bad if per se, but the kind of this market is going, that it's not good. And this some experience of social and solidarity economy showing that it's necessary to rethink the paper of the market in these relations. And for about the vision, the future behind the policy, I think that's important to sensibilization, institutionalization, networks, and tools to showing that the experience, the actions, and the social and solidarity economy has some aspects that point to a new paradigm and include some experience show us that exists a symbolical fight against the actual system, the capitalism system. And there are another questions, but it's the time it's not enough to advance, and I think that is okay. Okay, two more, but it's for the other one. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to our panelists. I think one observation we can draw here is that the social and solidarity economy is an issue par excellence which lends itself to South-South cooperation. Most of the examples that we heard today are actually from the Global South. It's it's an area where the countries from the South have innovated and provide lessons that countries from the North can adapt. And that's one of the reasons why the South-South Cooperation Program of the ILO has supported this conference. Thank you for your participation.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unriz.org. Thank you for listening.